What was life like in San Francisco for you and Irene? You know, you come from a small town in the South. What was life like living in San Francisco?
Well, we enjoyed it. I think we lived in San Mateo, and that's where both our kids were born, in San Mateo. And we'd live there in the summer, then I'd go back to Carolinas in the winter. We finally bought a home in Atherton 1 year, then 2 years later I got traded. But we enjoyed San Francisco. I loved to come and eat. That was back during the Haight-Ashbury days.
What did that look like?
It was kind of, it wasn't like Hickory Grove. I thought, man, what's the matter with all these people? They look so starry-eyed, and it looked like somebody done gassed them or something like that. It was a weird time in history during the 60s anyway. There was a lot of stuff going on everywhere.
Yeah. Well, you come from the South. And, of course, we had a lot of racial tensions in the 60s with spring training and the integration of the Florida areas and Arizona as well. What did you see in the 60s? What was life like? What did you see?
You know, I didn't really see much because I grew up in the country on the farm. I grew up all around the black people. I played on a black team. I was the only white boy. And all nine of us would get in the car and travel on Sunday afternoon. We'd get a stack in one car and go play all day and come back. And so I pitched. And a lot of times you go into town and they wouldn't let me pitch. They'd know if that white boy's pitching, I ain't playing. Because I was too wild. I hit some of them. I didn't mean to, but you just, if sometimes the guy was standing in the wrong spot when I threw. That was right by the plate. I never did notice that much of a, I don't know where I was, just kind of blinded to it, but I didn't. The 60s was kind of a era where you had a lot of stuff going on in counters, this and that in the South. But my whole theory was that they'd done everything backwards when they started the whole thing. They should have done it from the grade school all the way up to high school and then go into college. But they wanted to rub it down everybody and start it from college down, and that created... There's so much activity at college anyway that they try to throw that. If it's done in kindergarten, brought everybody up, because we grew up, man, all of my neighbors were black when I grew up, so we didn't have no problem with them. And they didn't have no problem with us. We just had a great time together. Then playing ball now, there's two or three guys on that club could have made it anywhere if they were white, I'll say that. But they were the wrong color and they didn't have the right people looking at them. Now, when I played in my first year, had Manny Lou and Manny Mota, I had to go pick them up at certain hotels in Michigan City because they wouldn't allow them to stay in Indiana and in certain places. So I'd always give them a ride to the ballpark every day until I done a kind of a tail spin at the ballpark one day. Then Manny Mota wouldn't ride with me no more. But that was quite an era. That was probably the biggest change from 1960 to 1970, in sports. And I remember they wanted the athletes to take a bigger stand. But I think they done the right thing. I think Willie Mays done the exact thing. Just go out and play. And I think probably baseball was one of the greatest integrators of all things. Because when all of a sudden you look in the stands, there are the black fans and the white fans. Or you look on the ball clubs, and all of a sudden here come Robinson, and then here come everybody else. Then you looked at American League. What was it, Dobie? Yeah. Dropa? What was it? Dobie. Yeah. He was South Carolina boy. Yeah.
Right.
It just kind of everything started melting in. And the only time it'd fire up is when everybody started mentioning something. That's the way it is today, though. Same, you mentioned some little bitty thing happens, they try to magnify it. But I think sports probably had as great a meaning to integration in for all things. Now you look at the lineups, and there's people from every walk of life. China, right. Even got some guys. Korea's got several guys that come along. I went over to Korea a few years ago, and they were just some of the big league ball players had gone over to teach baseball. And, boy, they've come along really good. And you look at all the Japanese, they all got that one same pattern. They all wind up, look, kick that leg, throw that ball.
That's good.
Uniform teaching.
Yeah.
Bobby Bolin with us. Great recollections. Very good. Now, what about Marichal and Roseboro? You were there for that game.
You know, I was sitting there on the bench because I think I was in the starting rotation about that time. And I was sitting at the bench, and you're sitting there looking, and you think, he's hitting him with a bat. Lord, he is hitting him with a bat. I mean, it was kind of unbelievable. But I look, and Roseboro had, I don't know what the story was, but I think Sandy Koufax was pitching, and the ball got away from him. And Juan said Roseboro threw it back too close to the, and so then when Juan started to talk to him, Roseboro made the mistake of taking his helmet off. And why, not helmet, no, mask, took his mask off. And then took a step to him, and Ron, reflex, he just cocked him in the head and then cocked him a couple times, really didn't. But he got enough to raise some blood. And it probably did give him a little blind staggers every once in a little bit. But, man, that was quite a shambles trying to keep the Dodgers off Marichal at home plate, trying to throw them back out of the way. But then I think they suspended Juan for rest for in L, and then wouldn't let him go back to L.A. the rest of the year.
Yeah, oh, that's right.
Yeah.
Yeah, I always say baseball mirrors what's going on, and you hear about those times, the riots and Watts were going on, and there's a lot of tension, and that was part of it then. But looking at that pennant race of the Dodgers and the Giants, and you were in two great pennant races in 65. I think you won 5-1 down the stretch. They used you a lot, and let's talk about how good you were in those days.
Well, I can't recollect too much. If I'm speaking somewhere and I mention now, somebody's got a Wikipedia thing,
right,
and they'll say, no, Bob, that was this, so I forget. I don't tell no more stories because I tell them wrong. But the But that was I had a good success. September was always my best month. It seemed like if somebody used me. But I remember we sat at the airport in Pittsburgh one night after the last game of the season, Koufax pitching against the Phillies over in Philadelphia. And if it lost, we go play another playoff. If it won, we go home. Then we had another place, too. We had two things back-to-back just like that every year. At the end of the thing. But it was quite, Dodgers was, you know, they had the pitching staff, Koufax, Drysdale, Padres, and
Sutton,
and all, yeah. Then the Mora Wills get on still first, still second, and Tommy Davis hitting something, and then Willie Davis in center field. So they had a quiet ball club.
What was it like playing with McCovey and Cepeda and Mays and Jim Ray Hart and Davenport? And you guys had quite a team. Ed Bailey came over to catch. Del Crandall was here.
Davenport just passed away here a few months. He was the most unrecognized player, I think, in the whole league. He was one of the best third basemen that ever put a uniform on because he could backhand. He'd do everything right. But he was a good guy. But that was, you know, growing up, Cepeda and I, we broke in together and 50, he started in 56, I believe. It was 55 or 56. Then I come along. We were at the same ball club in Minneapolis Millers in spring training with Cepeda, McCovey, and all those guys. We kind of grew up together. Felipe was there in the minor leagues also. So I'd known him. That's why the Giants, I spent 13 years, I guess, 4 years minor leagues, 9 with them. So I knew a lot of us. We'd grown up all together. So it was quite a – then to see McCovey and Cepeda, he went off to St. Louis and destroyed us a few years.
Well, Cepeda was traded right from the clubhouse right to the Cardinals one day.
Ray Sadecki. Yeah, Ray Sadecki come across, put the uniform on. Cepeda went over and put the uniform, started beating us to death.
Looking at Candlestick, Bob Bolin with us, Candlestick Park, and, you know, you're a fastball pitcher. I don't know, what do you think of Candlestick?
You know, Candlestick, I didn't mind pitching Candlestick because if you run that fastball in on them right-handed hitters and get it real close to their hands, it'll sting for 4 or 5 innings. But when they're coming up next, turn at bat, their hands step might be stinging from where I saw them off. But, you know, the Mays cost Willie a lot of home runs playing at Candlestick. And McCovey, man, he hit some home runs that nobody could measure. Hit him and that wind in back of him, and I know a lot of them went well over 500 feet, just unbelievable. But it was cold. I can remember we'd done a few things at the they didn't like. We put uniforms on the cyclone fence. You know, stretch them out like a player laying on the fence, and the wind was blowing so hard it'd hold up the uniforms. And we'd tie the spikes on there like there was a guy, and we'd put a hat up there. And then somebody took a picture of it, sent it back to New York. And so the Chamber of Commerce of San Francisco, they didn't like that whatsoever. So we had to stop doing that.
Looking at Candlestick and the kind of players you had and just the games you had there, it was nighttime. What were the fans like? I mean, they'd be huddled, I would imagine. They'd be sitting in the stands.
You know, and we would, a couple years, what, the last couple years, 8, 9, I believe we didn't have too good a year. And fans, and you got to win to have some fans out to the ballpark consistently. So the that's how I end up getting traded, basically. I was pitching against the Braves, shutting them out along about the 5th, 6th inning. And before I knew it, I was trailing. I'd give up 4 runs and hadn't been a ball out of the infield.
Right.
It'd be a pop-up to shortstop, and then Chuck Hiller tried to catch it diving toward it. Got up to one of the biggest wins we ever had at Candlestick. And all of a sudden, I'm sitting in there kind of brooding over the how hard the wind was blowing and throwing them rocks and them paper towels. I'd kid everybody that if you like hot dogs with mustard, just wait. One would blow by with mustard any minute. And so I said a few words after the game to a sports writer, which I didn't know he was writing for the Examiner. And so I get up, a friend of mine, Atherton, called me. He's a fire chief. Bob, did you really say that? I said, what do you mean? And he said, get up and get the paper. And that was the biggest headlines I ever got anywhere. And it said, Bowling Wraps Candlestick. And I'd said a few things there that, you know, the mayor ought to come out and sit on the mound and let the rocks hit him in the face. And said they ought to pull the plug out of it, sink it in the bay. Well, that was on Saturday. And Monday they were having a meeting to get the 49ers and the Giants to play in. They were going to get the 49ers to come over and play. So they had to get everybody to agree on it. So when I got to the ballpark that day, Chubb Feeney was waiting. I want to see you. Do you realize what you said? I said, well, I didn't know I said it to anybody who was going to write it. But I didn't pitch anymore. Then I got sold to Seattle or traded. That's how I ended up leaving San Francisco. Griping against the wind instead of bragging about it.
That's a story. That's a baseball story, Bobby. Thank you.
All right. Thank you, Marty.